Good morning. A little more than 2 weeks ago, the International Herald Tribune front page headline announced that what we might call the China station or Beijing station of the Atlas Foundation had been rolled up by the Chinese Politburo. Three of our principal contacts in the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences had been fired for their role in educating their students in classical liberalism. So according to the Central Committee in China, classical liberalism is still a crime. Yesterday, somebody referred to equated classical liberalism and economics, and that is totally not true. Classical liberalism and conservatism both share their acknowledgement of economics as a science, the same as they do physics. What classical liberalism distinction is that it's political philosophy. And in the spring of 1979, the Philadelphia Society had as its theme the subject of conservatism and classical liberalism. The dinner speaker was Robert Nesbitt, who was speaking as a conservative. And reflecting his noble character, Nesbitt selected as his liberal opposite number, F.A. Hayek. Comparing himself to one of the founding fathers of the Philadelphia Society, F.A. Hayek, Nesbitt presented his differences at such a high level and with such natural grace that all members were appreciative. Nesbitt gave his highest commendation to Hayek's The Constitution of Liberty, especially Hayek's emphasis on the medieval foundations for modern political thought, for constitutionalism and for Anglo-Saxon common law. Hayek's central contribution, the chapter 11, The Origins of the Rule of Law, is rooted in medieval thought. Just as Hayek progressed back to the Middle Ages, we as Hayekian scholars need to restudy the medieval sources in the political thought and in the legal institutions admired by Hayek and classical liberalism. Nesbitt likewise was appreciative that Hayek regained the central place for custom and for evolution of legal institutions. For Nesbitt, a number of Hayek's references paralleled Nesbitt's own contributions. Hayek, for instance, quoted Edmund Burke's tracts relative to the laws against popery in Ireland. Quote, Burke said, "It would be hard to point to any era more truly subversive of all the order and beauty of all the peace and happiness of human society than the position that any body of men have a right to make what laws they please, or that laws can derive any authority from their institutions merely and independent of the quality of the subject matter. No arguments of policy, reasons of state, preservation of the Constitution can be placed in favor of such a practice. All human laws are, properly speaking, only declaratory. They may alter the mode and application, but they have no power over the substance of original justice." Hayek's and Nesbitt's evolutionary legal thinking was best expressed by Bruno Leone in Freedom and the Law. Nesbitt's History of the Idea of Progress, published in 1980, is an important contribution to the history of classical liberalism. His demonstration that Christianity is the source of modernity is very crucial. The Christian fathers and their sources in the Stoics of the Hellenistic civilization established the foundations of modernity. It was Hellenistic civilization in which first Judaism and then Christianity flourished intellectually and spread geographically. For Western Europe, the great fruits of the Germanic tribes' migrations and settlements took time to flower. In towns, bishops were the residual defenders of Christian rights. In the countryside, the new institutions of the monasteries introduced by the father of Europe, Saint Benedict, were oases of justice. The founding of the Reformed Benedictine Abbey of Cluny in the Kingdom of Burgundy ignited struggles to defeat political powers and to reform the clergy. The Peace of God and Truce of God movements led by the bishops and abbots contained the political powers' damage to society. Trade and agriculture flourished, giving rise to the great Gregorian reform movement. Church offices had become the possessions of secular rulers, who filled them with retainers or relatives. The motivations for entering high religious office was neither ecclesial nor moral. It was to enjoy the incomes from church properties. Many succumbed to simony, Nicolaism, clerical marriage, and concubinage. The secular clergy's marriage ties to the nobility and provision of wealth for their children created major conflicts of interest. The Cluniac leadership of the Peace of God and Truce of God movements and later of the Gregorian Reformation was achieved by sworn oath associations. The sworn oath associations became the basis of the town corporations and their guilds, and thus the foundations of many Western institutions. The Gregorian Reform movement of the 11th century is the starting point of modern Europe's legal institutions. Among the scholars who have emphasized this are Harold Berman in Law and Revolution, and more recently Deepak Lal in his important work Unintended Consequences. The Gregorian Reform's challenge to political control of church offices caused a violent response from the political leaders. An important political pamphlet, Literature, was produced in the as the first major contribution to European political thought. That Latin literature is collected in three volumes in the Monumenta Germania Historica. Charles McElwain was a Harvard political theorist, much cited by Hayek. Among his important contributions was the growth of political thought in the West from the Greeks to the end of the Middle Ages. In there, McElwain states, one of the first great illustrations of the working of these new forces in the political thought in the West was to be seen in the unprecedented outburst of polemical writings which accompanied the struggles between the Emperor Henry IV and Henry V and Popes Gregory VII, Urban II, and Paschal II. Within a period of little more than half a century, it has been estimated that no fewer than 115 separate writings appeared in defense of the papal and the imperial pretensions, 50 of them on the imperial side, 65 on the papal, written by 65 different authors. And that more than half, the whole number came within the 27 years between 1085 and 1112. To us, this may not seem strange, but so far as is known, nothing just like it had ever occurred before. In number, in bitterness, and in the manner of political argument, these pamphlets of the 11th century mark the first definitive appearance of a type of political writing which was destined to monopolize the field for 5 or 6 centuries to come. The controversy marks an end, marks an era not only in the relations of church and state, but in the history of political literature. This ecclesiastical literature is nonetheless a popular literature, and in this lies its great originality. It was not written solely for the monasteries or for the schools. It aimed to make its appeal to opinion and to sway opinion, striking cases where necessary, and forms of expression clear, simple, and such as the people could understand or at least to retain. McElwain quotes from the famous letter written by Pope Gregory VII in 1081 to Herman, the Bishop of Metz, quote, "Who does not know that kings and rulers had their beginnings in men inspired by the devil, the prince of the world, to turn away from God and presume in the blindness of their lust and their intolerable arrogance to bear rule over men? their equals through pride, violence, fraud, bloodshed, and almost every known crime. Far better that any good Christian, rather than evil princes, should be considered kings. For the former keep strict rule over themselves for the glory of God, while the latter, seeking their own good and not God's, are enemies even of themselves and tyrannical oppressors of others. These are the body of Christ, the true king. The others, verily, the body of the devil. These former govern themselves to the end that they may rule forever, together with the highest ruler. The power of the others tends to this, that they fall into eternal damnation, along with the prince of darkness, who is king over all the sons of pride." Unquote. Harold Berman notes that the contractual theory whereby a government's legitimacy cannot be the result of its imposition on society by coercion, but only by compact. Berman sees contract theory as elaborated by the Stoics and the Church Fathers and as entering Western political thought prior to the 11th century. R.W. Carlyle and A.J. Carlyle in History of Medieval Political Thought and Theory in the West provides the analysis of this thinking. Carlyle calls attention in particular to the contribution in the 11th century of Manigault of Leuthenbach. Quote, "We shall presently have occasion to examine in detail the political theory of Manigault, the most incisive writer of the investiture controversy and the most unsparing critic in the Middle Ages of what he conceived to be illegitimate pretensions of the imperialists. Manigault held that any temporal power could only be legitimately derived from a compact with the members of society." Carlyle continues, quote, "He was perhaps the most vigorous assailant of Henry IV and the most radical theorist of the nature of government in the 11th century. He had as little respect for the arbitrary king as any of the 17th century or of the French Revolution," unquote. Manigault declared, he who was to have the care of all, to rule over all, should possess greater virtue than all, in order that he might administer his power with the highest equity. The people had not set him over them that he should act as a tyrant, but that he should defend them from tyranny. Again, unquote, again in another passage, he holds that the chief distinction between human nature and that of other living creatures is that human beings are possessed of reason, and therefore men can not only know what they should do, but why they should do it. No man can make himself king or emperor. When, therefore, the people set one man over them, they do it in order that they should give to every man his due, that he should protect the good, destroy the wicked, and administer justice to all," unquote. Harold Berman notes, quote, "As late as the 1080s, the Papal Party had invoked the compact theory to challenge the authority of the emperor, whose, quote, cruel tyranny over his subjects, unquote, it was said, had made it clear that, quote, the people are free from his lordship and from subjection to him, since it is evident that he first broke the compact by virtue of which he had been appointed," unquote. Quotation from Manigault of Leuthenbach. Manigault adds, quote, "To take an example from a meaner sphere, if a man hired someone for a fair wage to look after his swine, and then found that he was not caring for them but stealing, killing, and destroying them, would not that man withhold the promised wage from him and remove him ignominiously from his task of caring for the swine?" Unquote. Later in the same document, Manigault states, quote, "If, however, he breaks the compact by which he was elected, reason justly considers that he has absolved the people from their duty of submission to him since he himself first broke the bond of mutual fidelity by which he was bound to them and they to him, unquote. The themes of that pamphlet literature, a literature of 115 polemical pamphlets in the late 11th century, was continued by succeeding generations. For example, John of Salisbury emphasized there was no legitimate will of the prince. The prince properly observed the continuity of the evolution of judicial decisions. The tyrant is the ruler who interferes in the regular process of justice. Harold Berman says of John of Salisbury, quote, ultimately the reader is confronted with the startling conclusion that a person may have a right and even a duty not only to disobey a tyrant, but even to kill him. The famous right and duty of tyrannicide, which John of Salisbury was the first Western writer to elaborate as a doctrine and to defend with reasoned arguments. In the last analysis, however, every person is under a duty to enforce the law by killing a tyrant who has put himself outside the law, unquote. In the Constitution of Liberty, Hayek adopts Lord Acton's concept that St. Thomas Aquinas was the first Whig. Hayek draws heavily upon Lord Acton, as well as Fegus, Carlyle, and McIlwain for his analysis of early European political and constitutional thought. The same year that Robert Nesbitt addressed the Philadelphia Society in 1979, it was proposed to Hayek as president of the Mount Pelerin Society that a meeting be held in Spain. He agreed, but insisted that he would speak only at a session to be held in the Great Hall at the University of Salamanca. One highlight of that day was two small parties of MPS members, each accompanying Hayek and the other Lord Lionel Robbins, ascending and descending the spiral staircase which connects the ancient Romanesque Cathedral of Salamanca with the 13th century Gothic Cathedral. And the conversation between Lionel Robbins and Hayek in this spiral staircase between these two very historic cathedrals. But the spectacular event was Hayek's own address at the Great Hall on the foundation of classical liberalism in the School of Salamanca. It is widely known that the Scholastic School of Salamanca were founders of modern international law, as well as theorists of tyrannicide, limited government, consent, contract. It is Hayek and his student Marjorie Grice Hutchinson who recognized the Scholastic School of Salamanca as the founders of Austrian economics, or modern economics. They were writing in the 16th and 17th century in the wake of American discoveries of the consequent gold and silver imports and the financial crises of expansionist foreign policies. The consequence of Hayek's strong familiarity with that work of the School of Salamanca, as well as the work he was very familiar with of Raymond de Ruiver on late medieval economic writing, gave Hayek a much broader understanding of the medieval roots of classical liberalism, which are discoverable in the footnotes in the Constitution of Liberty. Thank you.